Assalamu alaikum, brothers and sisters. Welcome and thank you for coming. Today we're delighted to have Sister Zahra Faris. She's a graduate in Arabic and Islamic studies from the from SOAS University. She's a Muslim researcher and speaker and a member of the Muslim Debate Initiative. And she's actively spoken nationwide on topics like women's rights, hijab, and the niqab ban. Today she's going to present the talk on women in Islam, oppressed or liberated. So without further ado, Sister Zahra Faris.
Okay, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, wa salatu wa salam ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa ala alihi wa sahbihi ajma'in. Assalamu alaikum and greetings to everybody, and thank you so much for coming here this evening to listen to this topic. Now, the topic is women in Islam. However, I'm not just going to do the usual description of women's economic rights, women's political rights, and women's social rights in Islam. I'm going to do things from a few different angles, because we've heard most of those off-the-shelf kinds of lectures before, and they're very useful to hear, but we hear them year in and year out, but we still have the same questions. So I'm going to try and tackle some of the misconceptions, and I'm going to try and talk about some of the interrogating forces and why they ask questions about women in Islam in the way that they do and the types of questions that they raise. But I will include some of those useful and very important facts about what Islam does say about women at the relevant junctures in this presentation. Over the last year, or even the last decade, we've heard a number of claims mainly targeted at Muslim women, claiming that Muslim women are oppressed. And now such claims have generally or largely been dominated by feminists, liberal feminists, who cite things such as equality, freedom and empowerment, these three magic buzzwords that we often hear bandied around. So they talk about Muslim women being oppressed. The reality, however, is that Muslim people, men and women, human beings around the world of many faiths and none are oppressed in today's society. Consider the example of the Tunisian Muslim man, Mohammed Bouaziz, who set himself on fire, effectively igniting the Arab Spring. Why did he do that? He was frustrated by the unemployment, the corruption, and the tyrannical rule in his country. And he, like many thousands, hundreds of thousands of Egyptian, Tunisian, and Algerian men, all just wanted to provide for their families with dignity, but they were unable to. And this is what sparked the Arab Spring, but we don't call that a men's rights issue. We don't say Muslim men are oppressed. But when we hear issues about women, suddenly we say, oh, it's a woman's issue. Muslim women are oppressed. While there's wholesale oppression worldwide, it's quite flattering that Muslims are always taken to task on how we treat our women, as if to say that we should have a higher standard, and it's true that we do. But in reality, complaining that just Muslim women are oppressed is like complaining that, you know, the door of the house is not painted properly, when in fact the entire house is burning down and we're all on the street watching. So let's consider some of the recent claims made against Muslim women, and I'm going to look at three. I'm going to look at three claims that have come up perhaps in the last year. Some of them have come up recurrently throughout history, but here's some that are more fresh in our minds. So the first one is the matter of gender segregation. Now, most of you here, I imagine, are students, so you may know about what happened very recently at another university where they were having a gender segregated event. They didn't have like enforced gender segregation. They were having an educational event, and in the audience, which was a large proportion of those were Muslim, Muslim people were choosing voluntarily to segregate. So women chose to sit kind of in one area, and men generally chose to sit in another area. So they voluntarily chose to segregate. Yet Muslims were under fire for allowing this to happen. They said with a straight face, that Muslims were told with a very straight face, it's a gross inequality and it's an oppression on women to voluntarily segregate from men at educational events. And they said that this should be officially regulated against, and universities are now looking at how to police where people sit when they attend educational events, extracurricular events at universities. And most curiously, Muslims were told that this practice is against British culture. So they were told, one, it's misogynistic and it's oppressive to women. And secondly, they were told that it's, you know, it's completely alien to British culture. So the Telegraph published articles like, statements like, requesting that women in a public place sit separately away from men is entirely alien to 21st century British culture. Now, Not only is this completely hypocritical, given that in this country we already have gender segregated schools, we have boys only schools, we have girls only schools, we have Boy Scouts, we have girl guides, we have segregated PE, we even have Eton, a male only school of which there is no female equivalent. So to now suddenly be told that just because if you're Muslim you do it, suddenly it's alien to British values, we find that quite laughable. Not only that, but saying that if I choose to sit with a woman rather than man, somehow I'm lowering myself, says more about their ideas of women than it does about mine. So we're told that we must conform to the British perspective on the matter, and if we don't, that Muslim women are basically complicit in our own oppression. So that's the first example, and I'm going to link these all up at the end and you'll see where I'm going. So the second one is the topic of gender roles. So the Muslim experience in Britain is, for many Muslim women, is this kind of ongoing and growing allegation that Muslim men are misogynists and Muslim women are either brainwashed, complicit in their own oppression, or they're suffering from some kind of Stockholm syndrome, similar to being brainwashed, where they're oppressed but they don't know it and they love their oppression. So take the claims against what are made against the life choices of those women, many of them Muslim, who do not want to be CEOs, they don't want to win Nobel Prizes, they may not want to be the next Miley Cyrus, but those women, you know, who want to serve their creator, those Muslim women who want to serve their creator, and they've chosen that the way to do this is by being a good wife and a good mother. However, when we say this, for those of us that do aspire to that, we're told that this is not a worthy aspiration. We're told that this is a disservice to a woman's full potential. How dare anyone tie your worth as a woman to a man? But this rather sexist claim that tends to originate from liberal feminists is quite rich and it's pretty hypocritical. But firstly, it's made because they don't believe that women should be defined or valued in relation to men. Now, why is this hypocritical? Firstly, it's ironic because the whole thrust of feminism comes from distorted feelings of inadequacy and constant comparisons of women to men. How much men earn, what jobs men do, what roles men take. Not only that, but the concepts that feminists advocate, such as equality, freedom, individualism, these are also created by men. You know, at some point in European history, men came up with the concepts of equality, freedom, empowerment, and yet feminists take these terms and say, it's okay if we do it, but you can't take a culture that they believe is formulated by men, but we can use it to kind of, you know, say that you're not doing justice to womanhood. Now, if feminists are aghast at the idea of women choosing to seek virtue or righteousness through, you know, anything related to men, such as being a wife or being a mother, they're even more aghast when we explain to them that actually we don't do it for men. And actually, we don't do it for ourselves either. Rather, we do it to empower a way of life that we believe in. And in Islam, the role of the mother and the wife, whilst it is not the sole role, because Islam doesn't straitjacket people into roles, it is a highly esteemed role. So for us, when we do it, it's giving life to that way of existence and giving power to that and empowering our religion. Indeed, ultimately, the Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, peace be upon him, he said that even men's virtue would be measured in relation to their wives. He said to the men, the best among you, speaking to the men, are those who are best to their wives. So if being a good husband has for over 1400 years been considered a virtue amongst Muslims, why is it suddenly oppressive, restrictive and misogynistic for a woman who seeks the equivalent? Now, I'm going to come onto the final example. So first we had the issue of gender segregation, and then we had the issue of gender roles. And now I want to talk about the final one, which is the subject of the niqab. Now, until recently, any debate over the Muslim face veil, the niqab, so when we're talking about the niqab, just for a clarity of terms, we mean the cloth that not only covers the rest of you, but also covers the face, so all you see is the eyes. That's what we're talking about when we talk about the niqab. And so until recently, any debate about the niqab has been pretty academic, because so few women actually wear the niqab than don't wear the niqab. So instigating a national debate has in a way been like hunting mosquitoes with nuclear weapons. I don't know if anybody ever used to watch Monty Python, but there was one episode where the Monty Python gang decide that they're going to go hunting for mosquitoes, and they decide to use big bazookas and cannons and these really inordinately and disproportionately large weapons against these tiny, tiny creatures. And this debate has been very much the same. And yet the idea was planted earlier in the minds of the people, earlier this year, and now it's slowly being manured with arguments and excuses and reasons as to why, if not a legal ban, then it must be socially discouraged, i.e. it should be bullied out of society. And so we're told things like it's not civilised. So one newspaper published the following title saying, "Civilised society must not draw a veil over the niqab." So when we choose to cover in a certain way or practice a certain definition of modesty, we're told that it's not even civilized. Now, objectification itself needs no real introduction, but I'm going to give you some statistics. So a study conducted, for example, by Harvard and LSE showed that almost two-thirds of women thought that society expects women to enhance their physical attractiveness. And they thought that women who are more beautiful have greater opportunities in life. And more than half of women thought that physically attractive women are more valued by men. So in essence, it found that women see beauty and physical attractiveness as increasingly socially mandated and rewarded. Not only this, but further research found that 6 out of 10 girls stop doing things they love because they feel so bad about how they look. So how's that for liberation? Now, that's quite interesting because animal biologists have done certain experiments, and they basically found that living creatures could be made more responsive to exaggerated forms of visual stimuli, so much so that they would start to neglect what is natural. So they did, for example, one experiment where they observed a bird's nest, where they had the mother bird who was at the stage, or the parent bird, who was at the stage of feeding the small newly hatched chicks. And these birds were kind of blue with like a little yellow beak. And what they did was they put in a fake bird into that nest, and they made it much bigger than the others, and they made it a really shocking shade of blue, and they made the beak huge and yellow, so that basically it was basically an exaggerated form of the natural bird. And they wanted to see what the bird that was feeding them, the mother bird, would do. And the mother bird, when she brought food back, she would only feed the artificial bird and completely neglect the others. And what that shows, they found also, this is also replicated in human behavior as well. The fact that human beings can focus so much on artificially enhanced and exaggerated forms of beauty such that what is normal in creation is ignored. And we see this with the concepts of objectification today, such that men are chasing what is an unrealistic and exaggerated form of beauty, and women too are chasing that form of beauty. And it's quite funny because, well, it's not funny, it's very sad, because recently I was traveling on the tube, and you know, the tube was pretty packed, and you know, I was standing, and so you know how people kind of sit in London, when you travel in London, people sit and they read their papers, and there was one man kind of sitting, you know, sitting down, and he was reading The Sun. And so you may know where I'm going with this. If you don't, on basically, The Sun is a traditional English newspaper, and the third page every day features nudity, basically. And so this man was reading the paper, and he was sat between two women, and so he stopped on the, he opened the newspaper, and he basically stopped on the third page, and he lingered there for a good maybe 5-10 minutes. And I was thinking, that's disgrace. I was thinking, one, you know, it's abhorrent. But secondly, he was sitting next to two ladies, and I was thinking to myself, imagine if his wife knew. Imagine if one of those was his wife. And do you know what? It turned out one of those women next to him was actually his wife, and she had just resigned to this reality. She just resigned to this reality, exactly like the nest example, where the mother bird is giving all the attention to this exaggerated thing and completely neglecting what is natural and what is meant for it. Similarly, we see this in human behavior as well, except that human beings are supposed to be elevated by their intellect. We're supposed to be different. We're supposed to be different from the animals because of our ability to discern these differences. So for Muslims, covering up is a form of liberation. It's a liberation from, for example, not just what we consider to be, you know, male lechery, but also from, you know, jealousy amongst women, just generally being able to participate in society by reducing this element of, you know, tension between men and women. It's supposed to minimize that tension. Of course, it never completely eliminates it, but it's intended to eliminate, to minimize it as much as possible. And so for Muslims, covering up, whether it's the niqab or the hijab or the different levels of kind of modesty, the minimum being everything is covered but the face and hands. This is for Muslims a passport to participate fully in public life, so that we can go around with our, you know, our daily work. We can participate fully in different fields, science, medicine, education, or just go about our daily lives. This is a passport, and it's interesting to note that I discovered recently that the etymology of the word niqab actually means to make a piercing or to travel through a place. And for many Muslim women who wear the hijab or the niqab, it actually does feel like that. It feels like there's this environment and you're basically piercing it and traveling through kind of unseen, you know, doing your thing. And it's very interesting. It's like perforating society with your presence, but in a kind of, for us, a dignified and liberating way that makes our lives easier rather than harder. For many of the antagonizers of our concepts of modesty, and some of these angles come from some feminists, however, the idea that a woman should practice modesty is in itself, for them, the affirmation of a patriarchy. Now, just to clarify terms, when feminists use the word patriarchy, they mean basically generally male domination that has disadvantaged women throughout history. So they see that our concepts of modesty are another manifestation of this male domination. Now, when Amina Tyler, does anybody know who Amina Tyler, the Tunisian Femen protest, there's some nods and some shakes. Okay, so there's a feminist group called Femen, and they're Ukrainian in origin. Their first branch was Ukrainian, and they basically do protests of a political nature, what they consider to be just causes, but which many consider to be laughable. And they do this by the way they get attention is by doing their protests topless. So basically, it's very much they're supposed to be controversial, and they're supposed to try to get people's attention for the wrong reasons. And they thought that being, you know, advocates of women's rights, that they would basically put themselves on display because that would surely get attention. So one woman, a Tunisian woman from a Muslim family called Amina, she decided to do a Femen style protest. So she posted pictures of herself. This was quite a big furore last year. The year before, she posted pictures of herself on the internet, nude, with statements written on her body like, "My body is mine and not the source of anyone's honor." So she had this written across her body. And she was supported by feminists because, not just Femen, but other feminists too, because she was upholding one of the underlying fundamentals of feminism, which is that the idea of ownership over one's own body. So she said, "My body is mine," and feminists said, "Yes, your body is yours. Our bodies are ours to do what we want with them." Now, to give some context, feminists have long complained, and it's going to get a slightly bit abstract here, but just for 2 seconds. Feminists have for a long time complained that the female, the woman, has been regarded always as being enmeshed in her bodily existence. They call this enmeshment or embodiment. And what they mean by that is that women are seen as being bodies. They're seen as being just bodies rather than human beings having bodies. Does that make sense? Getting some nods, that's good. So they say that women have always been seen as just being bodies, whereas men are always seen as rational and having bodies. So they say that women are somehow perceived as being more biological and more natural than men. So the you know, summarize it as they say, "I am not my body, I own my body." This is what they say. But if we think about it, how exactly do any of us, men or women, how do we own our bodies? If ownership is control, then neither men nor women own our bodies. Did we give birth to ourselves? Can we will against aging or sickness? If ownership is not, you know, is not control, is it maintenance? If it's maintenance, can we survive without depending on other bodies, other human beings? Can we survive without depending on our environment for our continued existence? No. So Islam recognizes that we do not own our own bodies, and therefore we do not have complete autonomy over what we do with them, neither men nor women. Instead, Islam says that the body is like a trust, it's an amana, and it is entrusted to us, and it's our duty to fulfill that trust and to treat the body in the way that we are asked to treat it by the Creator who created it in the first place. So this is why feminists tend to clash with the Islamic concepts of modesty. We say we don't own our bodies, we don't cover for men, we cover for God. But they say, you own your body, you can do with it whatever you want, and you shouldn't have to defer to anyone, whether it's a male man or a male God. You know, unless it's, you know, feminists, you can defer to us, we'll tell you what to do. You know, our diktats do take priority. But it's funny because feminists have been annoyed that women are not seen as rational beings. However, they have applied the exact same prejudice onto Muslim women. They do not tend to see us as rational beings. So when we say we choose the niqab, or we choose to segregate, or we choose certain roles in life, they say that we must be brainwashed and we must be blindly following a culture developed by men. And they peddle, you know, this narrative that basically reduces Muslim men to savage oppressors and Muslim women as mindless victims. So for example, and this is just to kind of like crystallize it a little bit, if bad things happen in Western cultures, they're considered to reflect, you know, the deviant behavior of a few individuals, instead of, you know, the consequences of Western culture itself. But on the other hand, if the same bad thing happens amongst Muslims or amongst other minority cultures, it's considered to be a consequence of their whole belief system. It's not just a few deviant individuals. So for example, if you see someone called Dave, you know, he's walking down the street in Manchester or Southampton, and you know, he throws rubbish on the street, you know, the view won't be, oh, people from Manchester or Southampton are filthy. No, the view will be, you know, Dave's a bit of a litter bug. But if Ahmed the Muslim is seen throwing rubbish in the same way, you know, the conclusion more likely will be all of Muslims are filthy and uncivilized. So just to prove this, recently, we heard also in the news pretty recently of two cases of child grooming. So one was a group of Asian men of an Asian background who were found to be engaging in these horrible things relating to child grooming. And when that happened, people of the Asian community were told, you know, you have a cultural problem, you need to sort it out, that's giving rise to this problem. And then, not so long after, the exact same parallel mirror image incident took place somewhere else in England, except it was a group of white men. But nobody said, oh, there's a problem with, you know, with Western culture that's given rise to this. No. So there's an example of what I mean when I say that when bad things happen in Western cultures, it's not considered to reflect the ideology. But when it happens in Muslim culture, suddenly the ideology is blamed. We saw the same, for example, with Egyptian men who were, the New York Post basically reduced them all to being quote-unquote animals and beasts. They said Egyptian men are animals and beasts because of there was an incident there where a reporter was brutally assaulted while she was in Egypt on the ground. So there's another example. So the assumption is that generally tends to be that people of color or of a certain background are always motivated by culture, whereas what they consider to be Western white people are always motivated by choice or rational thought. So the feminist way of thinking that Muslim women are oppressed and brainwashed obviously stems from this, and it comes from the European or Western colonialist history in which basically the West constructed the East as being exotic and backward and less enlightened, and that they need imperialism to be rescued. And thus, the such types of feminists that I've mentioned also consider Muslim women to be exotic, backward, and less enlightened, and in need of rescuing from the niqab or segregation or from our life choices. And of course, they're assisted by a number of what we can call native informants, like Mona Al Tahawi or Ayan Hirsi Ali, who conveniently, you know, confirmed their suspicions in these regards. And there's a lot of history of this. It's not just what's happening in the modern day. This is actually a very old phenomenon that's been going on of trying to suppress Muslim women through these kinds of narratives. So, for example, you know, Lord Cromer. Has anybody here study history and know of Lord Cromer? He was one of the colonialists of the day. And basically, he was a British leader in Egypt. And he accused Egyptians of degrading women through veiling. And he said, you know, this is so degrading. You have to unveil them. And so he tried to basically hamper and diminish the practice of the hijab and the veiling in Egypt. And he attempted to show himself as liberating these poor women that need rescuing from these, you know, brutal and, you know, savage Muslim men. Not only that, but in his attempt to liberate them, he actually deprived them of many of the liberations that Islam had given them. So before, they would veil, they would have access to all different types of education, and Egypt had a strong culture of training women to be doctors. So Egyptian women would heavily go on to study medicine and become doctors. But so Lord Cromer, in liberating the Muslim women, basically said, our women at home, they don't go to female doctors, they do very well with male doctors, so you can do exactly the same. You can align yourself with women in Britain, basically taking away their rights to reduce them to what something that, you know, they had never experienced before. They had always experienced this kind of liberated way of existence. Similarly, it's quite funny because Mary Wollstonecraft, one of the early feminists who wrote about, women, she was one of the first writers, one of the first seminal writers to write about women in England and say that they needed feminism. She said in her introduction, you can go and look it up, she said in her introductory paragraphs or her introduction, she said, we don't want to be oppressed like the Mahometan women, i.e. the Muslim women. But do you know what was happening at the exact time when she was writing it? Do you know what life was like in the Muslim world? Well, at that time, and it wasn't a long time ago, it was only until as recent as 1924 that this reality existed. But at that time, the Ottoman Empire, the Ottoman Caliphate, actually treated women so well that non-Muslim women wanted to be treated the same. So I'm going to tell you exactly how that was. In the Ottoman Empire, they didn't have this one rule for all system. They didn't say everybody had to conform to this one ideal. So you know how we're told today that Muslims must conform to British values. You must basically water down your beliefs until you're the same as everybody else. This is very alien for us because in Islamic history, we never did this to anybody. So in the Ottoman Caliphate, what they would do is they would have an overarching legal system that everybody, regardless of faith, had to abide by. This didn't include acts of worship. This was like if you live in a shared apartment block and, you know, you have the communal areas where everybody abides by the same rules, and then you have your own apartment and you can do pretty much what you want. So it was very much the same. They would have different quarters or different different regions where different peoples of different cultures could live and not be forced to conform to this overarching kind of way of being. So they would have the Jewish quarters where the Jews would flourish in their own economy, their own trade, their own culture. They could appoint their own leaders from amongst themselves. They could have their own Jewish courts to resolve their disputes. They didn't have to go to Islamic courts to resolve their own disputes. They had a similar quarter for the Christian community, exactly the same, to allow them to flourish without forcing them to be something they were not. The same for the Armenians, the same for every different cultural group that there was. Now, although non-Muslim women had access to courts of their own beliefs, so Jewish women could go to Jewish courts, Christian women could go to Christian courts, they preferred to go to Islamic courts because Islamic courts were seen to be much more favorable to women's rights than their own courts were. So they would say no thanks to their own courts and go to the Islamic courts. This was at the time when Mary Wollstonecraft was saying that they did not want to be like the Mahometan women. And just like today, this is because of ignorance of the reality of what Islam actually says. The difference today is that we don't have a living example of what Islam would look like in practice. We have to refer to historical examples when Islam was actually implemented in full, because in today's world, there are no Islamic countries. We have Muslim countries which are basically secular, so they're founded on, or they run on secular principles, they have secular governments, and they have a few strands of the most graphic parts of Islamic law, which when taken out of context, look the way they do in the Muslim world today. So the arguments that are used against Muslim women, and just to come back to the example that we were on, the niqab, for example, are full of contradictions. So we talked about the niqab, we talked about feminist concept of modesty, we talked about where this comes from, i.e. historical colonialism and imperialist thought, why this was wrong. And so let's come back to the niqab itself. So there are arguments against the niqab, so we know how to deconstruct them and we can see them for what they are in today's world. They're full of contradictions. So niqab wearing women are being classed as either intimidating social deviants or intimidated victims. You know, you can't be both. It has to be one or the other. And so we see that the opposition is very schizophrenic in their claims. And I'm going to give you some examples. So please listen for the contradictions. First, the niqab is forced on women against their will, so these women must be forced to remove it. Second, the niqab is a restriction on women's life choices, so these women should be denied the choice to wear it. And this one is my favorite. The niqab is both demeaning to men, but it's also imposed by men, implying that men impose the niqab to demean themselves. The niqab is a form of sexual objectification, so Muslim women should reveal their bodies just like anybody else. The niqab is antisocial, so let's ban it, effectively confining these women to their homes, just like what happened in France. The niqab makes women invisible, and seeing them is really scary. The niqab inhibits communication, even if niqab-wearing women tell us otherwise, and even ignoring the fact that even surgeons wearing face masks, you know, they communicate just fine when they're performing open-heart surgery or saving lives, you know, in the ER. Now, do these views sound like, you know, rational thought? Are Muslims being asked to conform to this? Are Muslims being asked to take these arguments seriously? Maybe we should present what we believe about modesty and ask to see if they present any contradictions. If Islam presents any contradictions, then we should debate that and we should discuss that and show the hikmah, i.e. the wisdom behind why Islam says what it does about modesty, about life roles and about segregation and these things. The reality is that feminism itself is a pretty reactive ideology that has blindly followed Western philosophy of individualism. Feminists claim to abhor following cultures defined by men, but as I mentioned earlier, they advocate terms like equality and individualism, which were coined by male thinkers. And in any case, they're euphemistic terms. Even if you want to say, okay, fine, you know, they took these terms from men because they thought that these were good values. Even then, their euphemistic use of the terms like equality, freedom, and empowerment are very different to the Islamic equivalents of these things. We don't have the same meaning. We have different. We have a different understanding of equality. We have a different understanding of the individual and of liberation and of power. We have a completely different understanding when it comes to power. And in practice, we find that actually the liberal understanding of these terms, equality, freedom, and empowerment, are actually very contradictory. It's like calling equality, freedom, and empowerment is a bit like calling out rock, paper, scissors. Does everybody know rock, paper, scissors? Or Ching Chang Walla, some people may have called it. Each one intrinsically limits the other. Freedom, equality, and empowerment, each one limits the other. For example, if everyone is equal in the eyes of the law, then if I empower one of you, i.e. give you an advantage, then everybody's equality is negated. If if everybody has equality, equality then also constricts your freedom to do something that everybody else is not doing, because it forces you all to be uniform, it forces you all to be the same. And if you want to maintain your individual freedom, then that denies somebody else's power over you as well.
So as we can see, they all limit each other, and in effect, they all cancel each other out on some level. But let's consider the so-called feminist progress towards equality, freedom, and empowerment that they want Muslim women to emulate. The reason I mention them is because many of the criticisms or the claims that Muslim women are oppressed come from these quarters or are formulated by these quarters. And they want us to take on feminist values or liberal values, and they want us to embody them, and they want us to resemble how women, non-Muslim women, those who pursue feminism or Western ideology or liberal ideologies as a way of life, they want us to resemble that. So let's look at some of the so-called successes of feminism. And I'm often asked about some of the examples that, oh, you know, you're not talking about mainstream feminists, you're talking about radical feminists, and they're not all the same. But I'm going to tell you now, before I read these examples, these are all mainstream feminists. So, the first one. Feminists demanding that women's treatment, they say that it should never be influenced by their gender. They say a woman's treatment should never be influenced by the fact that she is a woman. But at the same time, they cite biological factors when they say that women with PMS should be considered to have diminished legal responsibility, i.e. it should be a legal defence if they commit a crime. And so they should be less accountable when breaking the law. And they also actually have a very sexist campaign to close down female prisons, but not male prisons, because they say female prisons are not really conducive to women's nature, as though it's conducive to men's nature. So this, and like I said, this is not a radical feminist movement. These are mainstream feminists. You can even look this particular thing up on the Fawcett Society, which is one of the oldest feminist societies in Britain, and its membership is by very prominent people who are policymakers in this country. Secondly, sexist quotas to get women into jobs based on gender rather than merit. In Islam, we talk about a meritocracy and not just giving people things because of their certain gender. They have the lavishing of attention on female learning needs, so much so that now university chiefs have considered male students to be a disadvantaged group. They consider male students to be a disadvantaged group when it comes to university. So how's that for equality? They're indicators of a positive correlation between the rise of feminism and the rise of divorce, with women being liberated from their marriages and children being liberated from their parents. The suffragettes, everyone pretty much agrees that the suffragettes, you know, they're not radical, they're pretty foundational, we have statues of them. The suffragettes' use of what would, in the modern day, would actually be classed as terrorist activity. They had letter bombs, property damage, even injuries to others, just to get the chance to vote in a system that doesn't benefit anybody but the elite anyway. They earn themselves the right to be taxed and become debt slaves to the modern capitalist state, just like their fellow men, and not to mention now the resulting backlash from many men's rights movements as well. So as we can see, rather than fixing the oppression that feminists complained about, feminists are simply reversing it. So with a car crash record like this, would Muslims, who have a perfectly defined and complete system to establish the rights of the rights and duties of men and women, why would we want to emulate the extreme and confused culture of feminism or liberalism? Why would we want to yield to their irrational criticism of our concepts of modesty, our concepts of inheritance laws, our concepts of family structures? If Muslims in today's world are oppressed, it's because of the absence of Islam and not because of Islam itself. For those Muslims who they work for and look towards the implementation of their rights in the Muslim world, they advocate the full implementation of the Islamic legal system to guarantee their rights and so that they do have recourse to justice, not just women but men too. As for those men and women who subscribe, and I don't just mean non-Muslim men and women, I mean Muslim men and women too, who subscribe to some of the contradictory liberal values that I talked about today, that is oppression, because that is oppression when the system actually works. When liberalism works, it oppresses people. When Islam doesn't work, people are oppressed. When Islam works, they are liberated. So So I invite those who subscribe to those values to question and consider alternative values, and I hope that those answers come to you from Islam itself. I just want to finish up by giving a quick rundown because of some of the facts of what Islam says about women in Islam. Just a very brief category by category, you know, some of the rights and duties that are afforded to women. So first of all, parity. Islam says that men and women, it doesn't just say men and women, it says all human beings basically start on an equal footing. Everybody has an equal shot. Nobody is by birth privileged. Nobody is by birth disadvantaged. So the Prophet, peace be upon him, said people are equal as the teeth of a comb. So black, white, male, female, whatever, everybody is equal as the teeth of a comb. That doesn't mean that everybody is identical in their needs. That doesn't mean that everybody is identical in their abilities. We see that not even two human beings are the same as each other. Everybody has a different strength. Everybody has a different intellect. Everybody has a different interest. Everybody has a different appearance. Islam, however, says that you start on an equal par. Men and women start on an equal par. And you can compete to be good, but what you compete in is righteousness. So in Islam, we are told that the best of you are those who are most righteous of you. It doesn't say righteous and male of you. It doesn't say, you know, those who are most righteous and female of you. It says those who are most righteous of you. It doesn't talk about gender. And in Islam, because it's about women, I'm going to point out some women-specific embellishments for women. So being a female, even as a child, even as a girl, without you even being fully, you know, mature yet of your own faculties, you basically are a gateway to paradise for your parents. So the Prophet, peace be upon him, said, whoever has a daughter and does not treat her lesser than a son and is good to her and raises her, you know, properly and justly, will be in paradise. So even as a child, she is basically a gateway to paradise for her parents. As mothers are basically due the respect of their children, so much so that somebody asked the Prophet, peace be upon him, who do I owe my time to? Like, with whom should I, who should I prioritize in spending my time? And the Prophet said that you should spend your time, he said, your mother. And then the man asked three times, and the Prophet, peace be upon him, three times said, your mother is basically most deserving of your time and your affection with it. And then he asked a fourth time, and then the Prophet, peace be upon him, said, your father. So we're also told that for Muslims, paradise lies at the feet of the mother, not the father. In other words, being good to your mother and respecting your mother is one of the most highest values, one of the most highest fundamentals or ethics or beautiful things in Islam. For every human being, which human being doesn't have a mother? Very few. So the respect for the mother is put on that level. Economically, if a woman basically does not have to work, obviously there are matters of compulsion, but generally the standard rule or the general status quo is that the woman is not obliged to earn for the family. Rather, the woman has a kind of a right to be provided for by her husband or by her father or by male relatives. She doesn't have to have the burden of providing for everybody or anybody. If she does choose to work, nobody has a right to her income. Nobody has a right to what she earns. She can spend it on her family if she wants to, but nobody can force her to do so. When it comes to inheritance, it is correct that the male receives more than what the female receives. And if we look at this with very materialistic, you know, lenses, as most people do these days, we would say, oh, that means that, you know, in Islam, women are worth less. But we don't actually value people by how much they earn or how much money they have or how much money they get. These are really materialistic ideas. We look at these things in a very practical and administrative way. So if the man is obliged to provide for the women of the family, he receives an extra portion from any inheritance that they receive for this very purpose. So he receives this extra portion, which is more like a trust. It's more like a trust, and the beneficiaries are the women. So basically he has to administer that for the use of providing for the family. And if he doesn't, then what does the woman have the right to do? Either she can take, within reasonable means, from his wealth to run the family or whatever necessity requires. Or she can go to the state. If there is an Islamic state, she can go to the courts and say, my husband is neglecting his duty. He has enough to provide, he's just not giving it. Then they can compel him to do so. So that extra funds, she has a right over it. Purely for administrative reasons, because in the eyes of the law, he is, or the male is kind of accountable for anything that goes wrong financially, economically. He is accountable to the state for what's happening with the affairs of this family. So that's a little bit about the economics. And, you know, I talked earlier about gender roles and how sometimes, you know, women prefer to be wives and mothers. And that is generally, most women in the world at some point will go through that in their lives at some point. But Islam also does, you know, give examples of, you know, women who work and women who are very ambitious. The first wife of the Prophet, peace be upon him, was his employer. She employed him. She was a businesswoman. He was her employee. And we also see, for example, in Islamic history, for example, again, referring back to the Ottoman state, and I refer to it because it's the most recent. It's not like it was 100,000 years ago. It was, you know, as recent as 1924. Women were so active in economics. They were so active in careers that in many areas, they actually had monopolies. They had monopolies in some areas, such that the government and trade unions had to intervene and kind of, you know, break it up a little. They were like cartels almost. So, you know, obviously that's not good either, so Islam obviously doesn't allow monopolies. But just to show that, you know, Muslim women, when the Islamic State is working, have the capability or the resources or the access to develop themselves in that way if they want to. But again, there's no obligation on them to do that. Politically, in Islam, a woman's pledge to the ruler is the same as a man's pledge to the ruler. A pledge to the ruler is kind of the equivalent of what you would have as a vote today, but in your overarching system it works out very differently. But the pledge is the equivalent, and a woman and a man's pledge are the same. Not only that, but women, just as men, are actually almost obliged to be politically aware and politically involved. They have an equal obligation to account the ruler if the ruler is corrupt or tyrannical. And they are basically, it is a requirement almost to have full knowledge and keep up to date with current affairs and know what's going on. It's not like you can shut yourself away in your home and be completely oblivious, because in doing so, you are not fulfilling the duty of what Islam asks us to do, which is commanding the good and forbidding what is not good. So commanding the good and forbidding the bad. And we have this duty not just between friends, not just between colleagues, but between husband and wife, between ruler and the ruled. Throughout society, we have this obligation. And the woman's political role is such that even if she gives refuge to an enemy of the state, if she gives refuge to an enemy of the state, the ruler has to abide by the refuge that she has given. He has to abide by her word on the trust that basically she's done it with good knowledge. It doesn't say, you're just a woman, get out the way, this guy wants it. No. It says, okay, this woman's given a word on our behalf, so we have to value that. So those are some of the kind of generic points that always need to be reiterated as well about women in Islam. And no matter how many times we say them, sometimes they are forgotten, or sometimes they are washed away or drowned out by what the media has to say about Muslim women, rather than what Islam has to say about Muslim women. And just to emphasize, because this, just to finish up, this point always comes up as well about, well, that all sounds great on paper, but why are we not seeing it today? And as I said, the reason is because we don't have an Islamic country anywhere in the world today. We have many Muslim countries that are founded on or run on secular values, but not on Islamic, fully on Islamic law and Islamic legal system. So to end, when we ask whether Muslim women are oppressed or liberated, we see that those who are subjected to liberal values, not just Muslim women, but women in general, not just women, but men, not just in this country, but pretty much all over the world, there is wholesale oppression worldwide. And when we just pick out the topic of women, we are actually only doing a selective examination of what's really going on. And this is in itself an injustice. Thank you so much for listening.